Good morning. It is February 5th, 2012, Super Bowl Sunday, and in honor of the Super Bowl, that's the subject of today's shiur. We were talking a little bit, you know, before we hit the recording on some of the methods of, you know, the types, you know, the way that we do some of the classes here. For the previous 2 weeks, methodologically, it was, you think, a little bit easier because, you know, we focused on certain, I'll put this here, halacha, you know, concepts where, you know, we had a citation, someone claimed of a certain idea. In particular, we had tzniut, modesty or humility, and chilul Hashem, desecration of God's name. In a particular context, someone offered, you know, saying, well, here's what it means or here's how it applied. And we went back to the Gemara to show that, well, they're actually, you know, here's what the range might be, at least in rabbinic literature. Methodologically, that's relatively easier than most because you can just search for a term, search for an idiom like Tzadi Nun Ayin or Chil Hashem, you know, put that into a search engine, come up with a bunch of sources, and at least that gives you some context for having a discussion. Today, we're talking about the Super Bowl. And, you know, when you're trying to talk about the Super Bowl in a Jewish context, it's a little bit more difficult because the Super Bowl doesn't exist in the time of Chazal. When did it start? 1960-something, I think, was the first. 1966. Was it Packers versus... Who was it? I think the Packers-Chiefs was number two, if I'm remembering correctly. I forget who they beat in the first one. Although there were football championships beforehand.
No, there were the Olympics.
Well, yeah. Football is never an Olympic sport, but that's actually...
No, I'm saying...
Yeah, so the truth is...
It's
a great point. We're actually going to get there. So we noticed that even when we talked about things, you know, on the, you know, halachic side of, you know, tziniyut and chilul Hashem, we had, I think, really good discussions, not just on here's the range in the Gemara, but even as we went through the Gemaras, people around the table there were coming up with different nuances of like, well, here are different implications of this Gemara, here are different implications of that Gemara. And that's just on, you know, one element. When you start bringing in external elements and trying to read that back, it gets a little bit more difficult. And here, it's, you know, it warrants taking a little bit to understand what goes into a modern-day psak halacha. And that you really have, you know, two things. I'm going to put Super Bowl here as just, you know, the example using the whiteboard for those listening. So, normally, right, we just had the discussions here about various halachic concepts. These would be various, you know, isurim, you know, things that are prohibited, and you've got things that are chiyuvim, things are obligatory. All right? And, you know, just in halacha, you can have so many, like, different offshoots. When you start off from the halachic side, as you know, said a little bit earlier, it's a little bit easy. You can plug something in, you can look up a book, and you can see up what the halacha is. But we're starting now from this end over here, in which case, when you have something like the Super Bowl, you know, one of the first things that you need to do, even before you get to the halachic question, is try to figure out what are the qualities of the Super Bowl, and to try to draw some sort of line between an element in the, you know, well, we'll talk about Super Bowl, but the truth is this applies to any modern day invention or construction, and how do the qualities involved in that item, subject, object, action parallel to a halachic concept. Now you can see just how difficult this is, because for the Super Bowl, we're going to have a couple of different qualities. So, and for all the halachic, for each one, it would have to map out to something in halacha. But if anything in halacha can be multiplied out in, you know, different ways, you might say, well, one quality of the Super Bowl from a particular perspective can meet up to one halachic concept based on such and such an interpretation. And you wind up having, you know, many-to-many correspondence, which is part of why halacha, or at least halachic discourse, is so diverse and why it's so many multiplicity of opinions. So, for example, how would people describe the Super Bowl? Like, what are some qualities of it? And, you know, we're not going to discuss every single one, but it's, you know, for the exercise purpose here. What's a Super Bowl?
I don't know. It's some quality. It's glorifying prowess.
Physical prowess. Okay, that's it. Let's get a little bit more atomic. You know, so you're talking about
football.
All right, so let's thank you. So football. All right, That's it. Anything else you can say specifically about the Super Bowl? Because let's not forget, I mean, you know,
it's sports.
It's okay. So we can put this under category of sport.
It's not on Shabbos.
Oh, well, unless you're, you know, a college football fan. You know, but you're right. The Super Bowl is always on Sunday. You'll see, you know, that matters at all. Right? What are the things you have that make the Super Bowl special? You know, because, you know, football happens on a, you know, weekly basis for a few months. Mm-hmm. Right? Is there anything more significant about the Super Bowl than anything else?
It's a, what do you call it, a secular holiday, basically.
All right, so you want to put down secular holiday. Okay.
There's the championship aspect.
Okay, my aspect. And what do you, okay, championship.
In other words, you're the best at something. That you're the world champion.
So this is best. You can also put down here quality. Meaning, ostensibly, like, you've got the two best teams playing in the Super Bowl. Granted, many Super Bowl games have been absolute duds, but some of them have been very exciting football. And you could also say that the championship element gives it a certain gravitas, and there's a certain additional excitement behind it as well.
I mean, are we making it too complicated? Because, I mean, they're... Like at the time of the Gomorrah, there were the arenas.
It
wasn't a bowl. It was a. It was a circus. Mm. A circus, which is just like a bowl.
Yes, so we're actually right. So you apparently looked at my sheer sheet beforehand. It's an excellent point. We're actually, you know, going to, you know, get to, you know, that particular thing. But you can see how some of those qualities in the Super Bowl may or may not link up exactly to a halakhic idea. And a lot of it's going to depend on how you spin any one of these ideas, like the qualities of the Super Bowl, with how you interpret any one of the halakhic concepts that you wish to draw a line to. So someone mentioned Sunday, right? You know, Sunday being a particular day. According to Rambam, Sunday is considered an actual religious holiday, you know, for the purposes of, you know, interacting with non-Jews. So would that have any significance with Super Bowl Sunday in terms of the applicability? Well, that depends how you treat Sunday. All right. And, you know, Dan was discussing earlier that, you know, what might have been the case in terms of a halakhic quality might not necessarily be transferable to the reality today. So today we're actually going to do fewer sources, but I would like to have a little bit more of a discussion on, well, based on a particular Gemara that I think does refer to at least, you know, some of the points that we've mentioned, to what extent would they theoretically, you know, pass for today, I guess, equate up with today or not?
I don't know. There's another aspect, which is that it's primarily a non-Jewish activity.
I think that would come under secular holiday.
Oh, right.
Although the truth is, I mean, you could say, you know, we can discuss whether or not it has, you know, religious significance, too.
Discuss, what's his name, Tebow?
Well, he's not necessarily, you know, although Tebow made a very good point recently where he said he can't imagine that he's the only sports player, the first sports player in history to pray on the field. There was also a comedian, I forget the person's name, who said that, you know, after the game, you find, you know, players often thank God, but no one ever said Jesus made me fumble. Which, you know, although this past year there was a wide receiver who did, you know, kind of blame Jesus for dropping a catch. And, you know, the truth is, you know, it does pose some very interesting, like, questions of theology of, like, well, you know, with all the things going wrong in the world, is God, you know, really playing around with the actual, you know, football game? And, you know, if so, in whose favor? But
there are a lot of aspects, too, that are kind of magical. Like, a friend of mine asked me to come over because he said the last time the Giants played and I came over, they won. I mean, at the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
like that. Yes. Super thinking that they should be in during the... if they don't watch or if they do watch, they're influencing the game.
Oh, sure. Superstitions in the sports, there's been a lot written on this.
There's such a high... The quality of the thing is that there's such a high emotion involved in the thing. That probably supersedes any other people's minds.
And that's going to be a very important component. I mean, certainly if it's one of your teams is playing, you know, for, you know, if you're a New Yorker, you're New York or Boston, you know, the respective areas, you know, you've got a huge fan base for both sides. Had the Super Bowl been, you know, 49ers Ravens, not as many people would care.
Yeah. Right. Is it emotional if you're not a fan of one of the two teams?
Not for me.
I don't know. A lot of people get really caught up. I mean, a lot of people get, even if they say, okay, you know, I like the whole fun part, but I'm not that much of a fan. But some of my friends who are fans, even if they don't have anything invested in either of the teams, once it starts the game, they decide, like, oh, either the whoever's losing, they get really...
You find some emotional investment.
Yeah, it's something that in the modern world might be like, if you ranked the way that people get emotionally involved,
mm-hmm.
it's towards the top of their involvement.
That's definitely... Well, I mean, I never went to a football college, and from what I see there, you know, there could be some analogous, from what I've seen, like how football players, you know, on the college collegiate level act.
One thing that's kind of interesting is that a lot of people who don't, you know, who are pretty sometimes in sports in general,
they just horse around.
They'll
sorry.
Yeah. In sports in general, and especially in these peak games,
mm-hmm.
They use it as a way to lose themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that, you know, in a context of they have, let's say they have more Kavana when it comes to sports and anything else, that's their say, you know, they use it almost as like a religion.
So those are important ideas to keep in mind, and especially as we go through the next, you know, sources. I want to start first off, I mean, we're going to get to some of those ideas, and I think those are important ideas to keep in mind actually when we do get to see the Gemara, you know, in a little bit more detail. So first, dug a little deep here, found a Gemara in Yerushalmi, in Ta'anit, 4, 5, or 67b, if you're using the academic notation, about sports in general. Dan, start us off, you know, going reverse order.
There were two, Yerushalmi, Ta'anit,
yeah. 4 or
5. 67b.
To explain what that is, the 4 or 5 refers to the way the Yerushalmi works is it's demarcated into chapters, which would be the 4 part, and halachot, which would be the 5. So you would have like Mishnah, you know, chapter 1, and halacha, alfekim all the way down. The 67b is a reference to one of the academic editions where you've got the entire Yerushalmi is in one folio. 67 would be the page, and each page has 4 columns. So it's A, B, C, and D. So there you go.
There were 2 cedars on the Mount of Olives. Under one of them, there were 4 stalls selling food preserved in a condition of cultic cleanness to be eaten in Jerusalem. And from one, they would produce 40 seahs weight of pigeons a month. And from these, they would provide bird offerings for all of Israel. From Shimon's gate, they would put forth 300 barrels of thin cakes among the poor every Sabbath eve. Then why was it destroyed? There is he who says it was because of fornication. There is he who says it was because they would play ball.
Yeah, the bracket is from the commentary of Jacob Neusner's translation. It says, V'yesh omrim shayu misachakim bakadur, that something was wrong with ball playing that would lead to a destruction. Somewhat of an extreme type of, you know, case there. Now, the editorial here is that they would waste their time instead of studying Torah. And we're going to elaborate on that idea from, you know, Gemara in Avodah Zarah 18b, which I think, you know, of the Gemaras, now keep in mind, you know, that whole tree thing that I set up, when you try to apply, when you try to apply halakha to a modern-day source, you have to do, almost by definition, more picking and choosing and trying to see, well, what Gemara should apply to this case, or at least, if even if you don't say it applies definitively, you may say in Gemara terms the Hava Amina, which is the hypothetical statement that you're going to test, meaning what is the theory? Like, do you have a parallel? What would make an intelligent parallel? And then try to see, well, does this really play out? Does this not really play out? So there's a lot more speculation in this way, even from the get-go, and you need to do, I guess, a lot more inquiry. Now, we're not going to address every single one, but you'll see, hopefully you'll find, like, yes, I did cherry pick this particular Gemara, but hopefully you can see why I thought this might make for an interesting discussion in order to, you know, start trying to make some parallels between something as modern as the Super Bowl and, you know, ancient halachic ethics. One question then, yeah.
Is there any description of what the game of ball that they played was?
Not that I know of. Yeah.
I was going to add, that certainly adds another category to the Super Bowl, which is not studying Torah.
Mm.
And maybe that's what, certainly from the standpoint of the person who submits the opinion, which you could say, well, it's just it's all part of the general category of
so
not Torah.
So you'll see, like, why, you know, this little emendation, you know, makes sense based on this next source. And we're going to spend a lot more time doing Gemara Avodah Zarah 18b. Billy, start us off, and appropriate enough because you raised the question before.
Our rabbis taught those who visit stadiums, arenas for gladiators.
And no, the Hebrew it's le'itz tadinin. So you can almost see the semantic connection between stadium and le'itz tadinin. Yeah.
Or a camp, the Roman castra.
These brackets here are Cencino's footnotes.
And witness there the performance of sorcerers and enchanters, or of Bukion and Mukion. Lulion and Lulion, Lurin or Salgarin.
Which, in the brackets, explains exactly what they are.
Names given to various performers and performances.
Mm-hmm.
Lo, this is the seat of the scornful, and against those who visit them, Scripture says, happy is the man that hath not walked in the counsel of the wicked, nor sat in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. From here you can infer that those things cause one to neglect the Torah.
Yeah. So had, you know, Mike's line there too that, you know, this is, it's citing here from the very first pasuk in Tehillim, Ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach ba'atzat rishaim, that fortunate is the person who does not walk with the advice or counsel of the wicked, uv'derech ha'taim lo amad, doesn't stand in the way of the sinners, uv'moshav leitzim lo yoshav, and he does not sit or dwell amongst the scorners. Or, I mean, that's going to be the translation that they have for late scene here. So the first, you've
sitting amongst us for is definitely described couches in living room.
Well, the truth is, you know, it depends on the commentary, you know, one has. But, you know, in the
or stadiums.
Right. So there's something wrong, you know. Just in general here, we don't really have too much detail. This is a, this is a rabbinic statement that says, if someone who partakes, you know, as a spectator in some of the, or actually not a spectator, but, well, actually, yes, someone who attends these particular events is considered scornful, which is, which is, decried in the very first pasuk of Tehillim. Although, it should point...
Meaning, what is the word there, scornful?
That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, leitzim could also, you know, mean as someone who is lazy or someone who is, you know, more indolent. Is an extended, you know, semantic range behind that too. You could say, well, there's more of a negative value judgment ascribed to such a person here than just not doing anything. Though, if the problem is mevi'in et adam lidei bitul Torah, you know, maybe they're synonymous. Maybe by, you know, not doing what you're supposed to be doing is itself something bad. Because note that it doesn't actually use the term here, asur, that it is forbidden to do it. But we can, you know, describe that a little bit later. So that's just point one. Continue with the next paragraph.
The following aside is contradicting the foregoing. It's permitted.
Right, so stop right here. So that's one rabbinic statement that says... you're not supposed to, right? But now we have a contradictory source that has to, you know, flesh out that idea.
It is permitted to go to stadiums, but opposed by shouting, one may save the victim. One is also permitted...
Meaning explaining from the animal which might be scared by their shouts is one interpretation, or...
Robbie succeeded in rescuing the victim by interceding on his behalf. So I know in gladiator shows, probably sometimes the crowd would vote.
Yeah, the thumbs up, thumbs down thing. At least, you know, that's what I get from all the movies.
Exactly. Rocky probably saw the same movies you saw. One is also permitted to go to a camp for the purpose of maintaining order in the country, provided he does not conspire, but for the purpose of conspiring, it is forbidden. Well, that... I don't quite understand.
Okay, I'll explain that in a second.
Conspire with the Romans.
Right, meaning it's a discussion here of, you know, camping. At least the way the Art Scroll, you know, fleshed it out a little bit more is that there was a certain type of a siege, you know, that was being conducted. So, you know, if you want to be there, as long as you're not an active participant in that, you know, siege thing, then it seems to be okay.
So the camp is where the Romans basically hung out while they were besieging the city?
That seems to be at least
one. There must have been Roman camps, military camps all over the place, that they probably had games.
Possibly. I mean, that could be, you know, a way of working it, but you'll see from the implication, you'll see that that may or may not, you know, factor up here. So, okay, continue.
Well, there is a contradiction between the laws relating to stadiums as well as between those relating to camps. There may be indeed no contradiction between those relating to camps, because the one way it may refer to where he conspires with them, and the other to where he does not. But the laws relating to stadiums are surely contradictory. They represent the differing opinions of two Ta'anim, for it has been taught one should not go to stadiums because they are the seat of the scornful, but Rabban Natan permits it for two reasons. First, because by shouting one may save the victim. Secondly, because one might be able to give evidence of death for the wife of the victim and so enable her to remarry.
Okay. All right. So here are a few things that we have on the halachic side of things. We've got on the, you know, negative side, the reason why you shouldn't go to... We'll focus on the stadium part because that seems to be more analogous to our modern-day sporting events.
Uh-huh.
Is this Moshav Leitzim, right? That, you know, there's something, you know, either unproductive or you know, not actively pursuing religious ends that's a problem. But you've got two mitigating factors here. One is you could actually help save someone's life. And two, if you witness the death of a Jew in the, you know, gladiatorial arena, you can testify before court, oh yeah, I saw him lose and his wife is now free to remarry someone.
Do they need two witnesses?
When it comes to testifying that someone died, there's actually a dispensation because you're not... You're testifying to a factual matter. And it's one of the things where, you know, Chazal did try to free Agu. No, that was one thing. You're just like, oh, yeah, you know, so-and-so died. So these seem to be, you know, you think about this a little bit. You know, we can sort of extrapolate that the saving life part meant that the things that you're actually seeing involved someone dying. And the problem isn't that you're benefiting from, you know, watching someone get killed, but you have better things to do. It's an interesting idea there. All right? Now, perhaps, like, do you think that the quality of this entertainment, the quality of the stadium, may or may not be analogous to the Super Bowl? And if so, or, you know, whether or not it is, what, you know, would the halakha, would you think the halakha would apply or not apply? Any thoughts on that? Right. Okay. Let's first off say here is you've got some physical combat in an arena. All right. Mm-hmm. That part is similar. Death versus non-death, or at least severe injury.
Oh, brain damage.
Brain damage. Yeah. There was at least 10 years ago. There was Sports Illustrated did a phenomenal expose on NFL players after they retired and just the horrific physical condition they're in.
Boxers the same?
Yeah, I would assume, you know, it would be with boxers too, although, you know, with football players, it was almost across the board from not just the head injuries, you know, from the repeated collisions, heart issues, because, you know, you build up muscle, puts a greater strain on the heart. It's a really, you know, nasty thing there. Now, the difference is, you know, you might be able to argue that even though injury is a side effect of football, do people actively want to see people injured? Well, you know, maybe if you're a Giants fan, you know, today you want him to go after Tom Brady, Gronkowski's got, you know, that ankle boots, you know, he's weak. But is that really the focal point of, you know, the contest? truth is the NFL kind of plays it both ways, and there's some sports commentators that point out the hypocrisy. That on one hand they, you know, have really clamped down on excessive, you know, hitting like helmet-to-helmet contact in the name of player safety. On the other hand, when it comes to video games, they tend to play up, you know, these big monster hits and, you know, trying to get the highlight reels that, you know, look a little bit better. But in either case,
it's a wasting of time.
Right. So this Moshav Late Scene part might still be applicable unless you say that, you know, maybe come up with some sort of a distinction, which we can talk about a little bit later. So the quality of the sport might have changed, but if the reason is Moshav Late Seam, well, that could apply to almost anything.
Yeah, I mean, these positive reasons for going to the game certainly don't apply here. You're not saving anybody's life by going to the game or watching the game.
Also, you know, because it's not a life or death thing, I mean, no one's going to kill Mark Sanchez for, you know, not being a good quarterback. At least intentionally. I mean, no, the truth, I mean, we're not as crazy about football here as, say, soccer. I mean, there were stories of, like, I remember there was someone in Colombia. Now, someone in Colombia, was shot. I think it was either the goalkeeper for giving up a goal, or it was an own goal, actually, and, you know, someone shot the goalkeeper. You know, we don't do that in the NFL today. Although, the kicker, no, that's not true. The kicker for the Ravens, who blew that last-second kick, got death threats. After the game. Now, no one's actually going to act on it, but at least in the spirit of competition, no one is praying for someone to die, and certainly no one in the stands is going to, you know, yell at Bill Belichick, is like, Brady's clearly not working well, take him out. Right? So, these mitigating factors aren't going to kick in.
So, it's interesting, the positive aspects of watching are nullified by the fact that it's not life or death.
You know, but it's funny, when you say that's a positive aspect, right?
Well, no, but that's the part that allows you to go to it.
Yeah, you see, it's hard for me to say that that's a positive aspect, though, because you're saying, like, oh, you can go only if you cheer for the guy to be saved? Like, what if you don't? Right? It's like, the way that it's phrased here is, you know, it's, you know, why could you? Why is it mutar? It's Rabbi Natan Matir mi penei shnei devarim. Right? He permits it because of two factors. He doesn't say when you go to these things, you actually have to do so. Right? It's not like, I have to save him at least once, like, you know, yay, and then, you know, go back and get some popcorn. You know, and you fulfilled your obligation. Mm-hmm. All right? You know, in a way, it's
rationalization for going.
That could be a way of reading it, right?
There's a statistical argument.
Yeah.
That I don't know that any one person will save anybody's life.
Mm-hmm.
But if we permit 200 people to go, there's a decent chance that one of them will save somebody's life.
So then, if it's a matter of saving someone's life, why would it be matir and not a chiyuv? Say it's an obligation for Jews to attend stadium and always vote to save someone's life.
Because then you don't really know that somebody that like you're going to save.
But then you'll.
Whatever the emergency things. What do you call it? People
go
up. Yeah, that's all. People don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. But it's permitted because.
Pikuach nefesh. If it's if it's in your capacity to save someone's life, you know, ta'amod al damriyecha. You know, if you see someone, you know, drowning, and you can save that person at no cost to yourself, you have an obligation to do so. All right, let's continue on with another. George, take the next paragraph here. This gives a different approach to the question.
A rabbi's thought. We should not go to the theaters or circuses because entertainments are arranged there in honor of idols. This is the opinion of Rabbi Meir. But the sages say, where such entertainments are given there for the prohibition of being suspected of idolatrous worship, I don't understand. Right.
It's an issue of the place. According to Rav Meir, the problem is that they're tied to idolatry. And the sages say where such entertainments are given, there's a prohibition of being suspected of idolatrous worship, and where such entertainment is not given. Meaning if the place where it normally takes place is normally for idol worship, then that's a problem because of idol worship. But if not?
The prohibition is because of being in the seat of the scornful. What is the difference between these two reasons? According to the sages, one is forbidden to enter such places in any case. Is there any difference between a place where idolatrous entertainment are present or absent? Said Rabbi Haninia of Surah, there is a difference in the case of calling to do business. Mm-hmm. In the absence of idolatrous entertainment, the sages would not forbid the going to such purpose, since purpose is not to sit in the seat of the scornful.
Yeah. So as I can put it here, we have, you know, a contrast, or at least according to Rav Meir and the rabbis, between whether or not it's idol worship or idol worship. See what I did there? Anyway, okay, so we have now an idolatrous component here. So what do you think? Super Bowl idolatry. Think it is? I mean, they're playing for a statue. And some party trophy. Like.
My intention is not to be part of the idolatrous worship, but mm-hmm. I'm conducting business, and this is a cover for doing it. Or a place where we can meet mm-hmm. to do the business, and it's okay.
I'll do you one better, and I included this as source number 3, and it's worthwhile, you know, I couldn't interject it there, but this in Gemara and Shabbat 150a, which is the last source on the page, the discussion in the Gemara is about certain types of communication and speech being prohibited or permitted on Shabbat. And according to Rav Shmuel Bar Nachman in the name of Rav Yochanan, that you can go to theater circuses and basilicas, right, to attend to communal affairs on Shabbat. Implication being, I mean, certainly if you could do it on Shabbat, you could do it all year round, but the implication being that these are places where you could go to because they were crucial for doing business. Because if these were the major cultural centers and this is what people were doing, it's almost like you had to do. So, doing it for business purposes. So that, right? Yeah, what do you think about this?
I think it's a big part of why, I mean, you know, in businesses, in the larger sense of, you know, getting contacts and keeping contact with people, I mean, it allows you to have a common way of talking with yeah. everybody in the culture. When you talk sports, like you could talk sports to a cop, you could talk sports to the guy on the street in the on the mm-hmm. whatever store you're going into. It's like a communal kind of jargon that's like
beautiful for people. So you just hit another point, which I'd like to throw out as a possible subtext here. You mentioned this communal type of thing. What do you think might have been the issue here in terms of assimilation and acculturation? Meaning, going to this place of business, right? Going to a sporting event as a place of business mm-hmm. meant that if you wanted to do business with non-Jews, you would have to be somewhat part of the culture. Mm-hmm. What do you think that would have meant, you know, both at certain times, you know, either then and now? Let's, you know, draw the point home a little bit more. Most of the discussions here have been Tanaitic discussions, and the Tanaim lived in Israel, which meant that when you're talking about the theaters, you know, the circuses, whatever, you know, type of entertainment, the, you know, mindset of what would have been going on would be more of the Greco-Roman culture, all right, as opposed to, say, you know, later commentaries that would be focusing on more of the, you know, who might have been from Babylon or Babylonia who were discussing these ideas would, you know, focus on things a little bit differently. For the people in the time of, you know, let's say under Hellenism or a little bit later, acculturation and assimilation were very real threats. Going to these, you know, major types of events show that you're part of, you know, the non-Jewish secular society. That effect would not have been as strong if you lived in Babylon a few hundred years later. Mm-hmm. Right? So you can understand it a bit. Well, you know, if Leibniz is like, well, you know what, for, you know, if you're going there for business, I can see why that's okay, because maybe later on it wouldn't have been as much of an issue for them, whereas in earlier generations, even the business part might have been, you know, a little mm-hmm. bit too much. But if you want to apply it to today, well, what would the Super Bowl say either about, one, assimilation, two, the need to follow the Super Bowl, just to have that common cultural language with which to discuss, you know, even topics with people. To give one example, I had a cousin who got bar mitzvahed over Thanksgiving, and it was the Thanksgiving of the Leon Lett game, Cowboys, Dolphins. You remember that one? It was snowing in Dallas, And Leon Lett is most known for two really boneheaded plays. One of them was in the Super Bowl against the Bills, where I forget if it was he was a defensive player. He picked up a turnover. I don't remember if it was a fumble or an interception. And he was showboating. He was about to have a touchdown. And some guy on the Bills ran behind him and knocked it out. Now, the Bills were already getting blown out, so it didn't affect the score. The people just thought it was a really boneheaded play. Mm-hmm. The Thanksgiving game, he actually lost the game for them, where the Dolphins were going for a last-second field goal in the snow in Dallas, and had no one touched the ball, just, you know, clock would have run down, would have been dead game, Cowboys would have won. Leon Lett slides in, tries to pick up the ball for some inexplicable reason, but he didn't. Once he touched the ball, it was live again, and someone on the Dolphins, you know, wound up picking it up in the end zone. So instead of getting a field goal, they got a touchdown, game over, Dolphins win. And on the plane ride back, pretty much everyone was talking about the game because, you know, Thanksgiving is another huge football day because, you know, God forbid anyone wants to spend time with family. So, you know, just watch the game. Yeah, you know, all right. So there's a certain cultural significance to it that's certainly exacerbated with the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that? From, you know, either the acculturation standpoint as a necessity or risks associated with assimilation or what that might connote in today's culture.
Is there anything about physical game playing for improving one's own health and maintaining a healthy state?
Right. So I think that works. Like for the first Gemara that we saw about, you know, city being destroyed Hars HaTzim at least being destroyed for playing sport, you can certainly come up with a better justification for playing football, for playing basketball. But we're not talking about the playing aspect as much as being the spectator.
Yeah, because the participation thing, that opens a whole ball of worms with that, especially in the Hellenistic period of playing naked and all this kind of stuff. Didn't they, isn't there a lot of commentary on that kind of thing, or is it just historical part of the Hanukkah story thing?
I'd have to double check exactly, you know, what was going on where. At least the rabbinic reactions to those things. But certainly today, you know, participating in a, you want to, like, you know, I know now a bunch of people in this show are part of, you know, regular basketball games Sunday mornings with a lot of, you know, other Jews in the neighborhood. That's clearly exercise. Right now, there's clear health benefits in that thing, but being a spectator, right, is more of a, it's you're a passive observer there.
Yes, certainly not healthy considering what people eat.
Mm-hmm. Right now, we
try it also.
Yeah, we have like, I want to, you know, skim through this next, you know, large section here that goes through this whole thing about walking in the way of the sinner, just how bad it is. That if he did not walk this way at all, how could he stand there? If he did not stand there, he obviously could not sit. If he did not sit amongst them, he could not have scorned. The wording is to teach thee that if one walks towards the wicked, he will subsequently stand with them. And if he stands, he will, at the end, sit with them. And if he does sit, he will also come to scorn. And if he does scorn, the scriptural verse will be applicable to him. That if you are wise, thou art wise for yourself. If you scorn, thou alone shall bear it. According to Rav Shimon ben Pazi, as he continues, there's a slippery slope of what happens in terms of scorning, in terms of you go from like walking to standing to sitting, where, you know, you first like, oh, I'm just distance. Like, no. Eventually, you actually become involved, and you become a participant, not just an observer for
Mixed dancing.
Exactly. It leads to, well, actually, it wouldn't be mixed dancing. It would be mixed seating. That would be the problem. And by that time, you wouldn't even be mixed, because now you'd actually be part
of them.
You'd
be one of them.
You'd be one of them, yeah. So said Rav Elazar, he who scoffs, affliction shall befall him. As it said, now therefore do ye not scoff, lest your punishment be made severe. Rava used to say to the rabbis, I beg of you, do not scoff, so you incur no punishment. Rav Katina said, he who scoffs his sustenance will be reduced. As it said, he withdraws his hand in the case of the scoffers. Shimon ben Lakish says, he who scoffs will fall into Gehenna. It says, a proud and haughty man, scoffer is his name, workest for arrogant wrath. And by wrath not is not but Gehenna is meant. As it is said, that is the day of wrath, referring to the day of judgment, where the wicked will be sentenced to Gehenna. Now, that's a pretty severe punishment for just, you know, going to see a football game. Ravoshi has said, he who falls a haughty into Gehenna, as it is said, a proud and haughty man, scoffers his name, worked for arrogant wrath, and by wrath not but Gehenna is meant, etc. And some more other things about bringing the destruction of the world. Said Revelezer, is indeed a grievous sin, since it incurs affliction at first and extermination at last. So it's a little bit more of homiletic teaching on that. When it says, when the sort of attributing a greater weight, that when Chazal attribute to someone that you are in Moshav Leitzim, that that's not just being homiletical. Right, it's actually, you know, or, well, I guess it is being homiletical still, but it's a lot more severe. It's like, okay, yeah, that's just a verse in Tehillim. And now it's just actually trying to say, hey, there's a lot more at stake here than just doing something that Tehillim doesn't like. Take the last paragraph there with Rav Shimon ben Pazi again, who actually introduced the previous section about Moshav Leitzim.
Rav Shimon ben Pazi expounded that verse as follows. Happy is the man that hath not walked, i.e. to theaters and circuses of idolaters, nor stood in the way of sinners, that is he who does not attend contests of wild beasts. Contests of wild beasts with beasts or with men, hunt of animals. Nor sat in the seat of the scornful, that is he who does not participate in evil plannings. And lest one say, since I do not go to theaters or circuses, nor attend contests of wild animals, I will go and indulge in sleep. Scripture therefore continues, and in his law doth he meditate night and day.
Okay, so here, I mean, it serves as a nice little bookend, right? The Torah Ge'yom Mamba Laila, that, you know, really you're not supposed to go to these things, as we told Torah. Let's say someone says, okay, I'm just going to go to sleep and not do these sorts of things. Well, you really should be learning Torah. Now, this, you know, also shows, you know, where the arrows get a little messed up. Because if you really want to apply this Moshav Leitzim and define Moshav Leitzim as somehow as being, I'm sorry, just running out of room here, as being not equal to Torah, well, you can ask the question then, what about any form of recreation? All right? This wouldn't necessarily have to be limited to theaters and circuses, or watching sporting events. It should in theory apply to, well, anything. Because when you're doing, like, either watching a movie, going to a concert, you know, or anything like high culture or low culture, whatever you're doing, it's not Torah. Do you consider that that would be considered Moshav Leitzim as well? And what might be the implications today? But also consider, what would have the society been like in the time of Chazal, and whether or not these things are kind of analogous?
Well, I guess, I mean, the amount of, I mean, what we have is popular entertainment or even high cultural entertainment in these venues that are separated from, you know, that are set up as separate from, like, whatever else we're doing. I'm sure a lot of the music was probably as part of temple worship and things like that, and as part of the culture, which was Jewish at the time, so that it would have been embedded in what they were doing, especially since it wasn't yet prohibited on Shabbos and things like that. The music and music was prohibited on Shabbos before.
In the temple
before the destruction of the temple.
Well, yeah, you have a Mishnah era source for it, so I'm not sure what that Mishnah would have been written, but
it would have been culturally embedded. It would have been specifically, you know, of the place, Jewish there. So the only, when we think of culture, since we're so segmented, it's more analogous to going to a circus or a sports event, because it was a separate place where you go just for the entertainment. It wasn't part of.
Okay, which is why I use the term recreation.
Which is why, in general,
let's view it as a full recreation.
So I'm saying that, like, listening to music or singing or things like that would have been embedded in the culture. So it would have been. We have this strange thing where we go
for any kind of entertainment, we segment it from what we're doing. So it could be said that it is a distraction. It is a distraction from Torah, or, you know, the life of the Torah, you know, leading a life according to the Torah and things like that. So it might, you know, it might very well apply.
Okay, well, I want to throw out two possible ideas here. One is a question of leisure time. Right, in the time of the Gemara, as far as I know, leisure time, or from what I know of anthropology at least, which we could argue how much it is, we have a lot more leisure time today than you might have back then. Certainly, our days are longer; like we don't shut down at sunset, and we just make more use of the time that we have during the day. Now, if you spent most of your day working, or you should have spent most of your day working. If you weren't working, well, what else would you have done? Well, you could have, learned Torah. Whereas today, if you have, let's say more usable hours of the day, in theory, could you make time for both in terms of prioritizing? We do have examples in the Gemara where Tana'im and Amorim did go off for some sort of recreational purposes. Right? It's not intrinsically prohibited. There's some warnings about doing it excessively, but there's a recognition of you have to, part of some, healing, restorative type of process. Right?
So,
there's one thing about going to spa in Tveria would be one example that was given.
Mixes are.
That was a leisurely activity. It could have also been done for hygienic purposes, not just for taking some time off. Whereas today, let's say you have learn for an hour a day, and you could also watch football for whatever that time period is. Do you think that might make a distinction between what might be considered Moshav Leitzim or following Moshav and Ben Pazi is really, no, you actually do, unless you maximize efficiency, or not, it's actually not inefficient, unless you maximize your time and spend any moment that you're not doing something, that you have any free time, so to speak, it ought to be dedicated to Torah. Otherwise, you're actually considered Moshav Leitzim and thus going to, based on the previous expositions, going to Gehenna and ultimately responsible for the destruction of the world. It's pretty heavy. Yeah, and then yeah.
The concern seems to be for acculturation and assimilation.
No, that was a theoretical possibility. Yeah, because the main thing that was repeated was Moshav Leitzim. I threw that in as a possibility given some other things that we know about the culture.
But the thing was to stay away from idolaters and the scornful.
Yeah.
Rather than that we might be able to change them as opposed to them influencing us.
Well, you might say that we could have changed them if you follow the thing of you go to the theater, the theater to cheer to save someone's life. Then that could be considered you're actually changing them. No?
No, because you're doing something that you are aware of, but that they are not aware of. So, for example, if I went to a discourse where I argue some points, then I have, quote, an opportunity to influence them.
Okay.
But if I avoid that interchange, then I have no hope, and I'm afraid that they're going, and I don't because I'm afraid they're going to change me.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'll have to switch it because of the emphasis that they have, or I guess, maybe, I don't know if you've brought up more than once, that if you think that you're just standing around first and that you're not getting involved and that eventually you get involved and you become part of the scornful, seems like the kind of assimilation problem. And also it leads to, it also has that, it seems like it's treated a little in the way that that you've had discussions of Avodah Zarah, the attitudinal discussions there. You know, it seems like it would be, what the worry is not that you just be sort of loving and sorry, or even be entertained, but get into that, where, your whole being is involved in the whole thing. And I think, I go that way because I'd like to think it's that tendency because it's an interesting, if you go to a church or something like that, if you're going to look at the artwork and things like that, but then, you might sit there and you might start worshiping the thing that's going on.
My kind of question, I want to get back to that point in a second. That was the second point I want to bring up. You had a point.
I was going to say, Rabbi Shimon, it seems to me trying to reconcile Rabbi Shimon and Pali with everyone else seems like stretching things because he seems so. If once you say you don't even like, you're not even against sleep, he seems like he's kind of off to the extreme in some sense.
But that doesn't negate from the previous point. Meaning he could be saying, well, here's the ideal, uh-huh. and kal vachomer, right, you know, logical exposition, well, certainly that would apply to other things.
Right. Now, you can't sleep
I don't, right, so I don't think, you know, he's going, well, I'm not going to read his mind on this, but it could very well be like, it's funny because it's you know, weird to remind people that frequently rabbis do engage in hyperbole. so it could very well be that, you know, that's the intent of like kal vachomer is like, you know, you shouldn't even like you and to you know, get in your head this epic that you're supposed to spend as much time as possible learning. Mm-hmm. So granted, like sleep would be better than the other, but you know, ideal is learning Torah and set some, you know, set the high bar basically.
Yeah.
Now, sort of getting to Billy's point, this was the other thing I wanted to mention. Different people watch football for different reasons, with a different sort of investments involved. Example, if you are a fan of a team, you're going to be rooting for that team's success, you know, regardless. You have certain people who appreciate the aesthetics of football, certainly more than others. Some people get into the game even though they have no idea what's going on. Other people really like getting into all of the details. There was a discussion this past year about A22, which is a camera that's set up in stadiums that's the sky type of camera. It's like from the top down where you see all 22 players. That's how you get the A22. And the NFL apparently closely guards that videotape because if you watch it, you actually wind up understanding the game a whole lot more because as people point out, you know, if you've got 22 players on the field, but only one person has the ball at a given time, and the camera only focuses on the ball, but if you see all 22 players, you can actually see, like, how defensive schemes and offensive schemes interact. You can see how, like, a block, you know, maybe 10 yards away from the ball might have affected, you know, the actual end of the play. And there are people, someone actually had, I think they had a poll this past year, like how much would people be willing to pay just to see that footage? People would pay like hundreds of dollars per game so that they can really wrap their heads around it. And other people who do get into it, or I'll give another example, you know, that is kind of applicable here, is soccer. Americans, most Americans, don't appreciate the aesthetics of soccer. You know, when I watch a game with like Brits or, you know, South Africans, you know, they actually know what's going on. And, you know, we joke that it's like, oh, 90 minutes for a 0-0 tie or nil-nil, if you're speaking the vernacular. But they can actually appreciate, like, oh, you know, see the kind of, like, they can actually appreciate. Exactly. So would you say there would be a distinction, like you mentioned about getting into it? What if you get into it because you appreciate the strategic aesthetics of it? Or if you take something like baseball, where the strategy is, let's say, not as apparent. I mean, there is some strategy in baseball, but it's usually like, there are baseball fans who probably yell at me about this, but I would think the strategy involves of like pitching matchups. Mm-hmm. How do you position fielders? It's not nearly as apparent, though, as something like football, where you have to come up with these offensive and defensive schemes. Do you think that would make a difference? If you watch the game because you appreciate, you're not out there necessarily for the violence, but because there is some, you know, cerebral component to it that you can understand.
It's not a matter of like what part you're actually interested in. Even if you like, you know, you're interested in watching violence or whatever, it's losing yourself when it becomes like real avoda.
Mm-hmm.
you're losing the context of the whole thing. I mean, mm-hmm. if you really appreciate the aesthetics of it, yeah, that aesthetics is sort of a dispassionate appreciation of something. It's when you get so emotionally involved that it's your whole being. Because that's where you people really...
Where would you draw the line? Like, you know, if you go to a sports bar, you see people are crazy into it. Where would you...
If you're enjoying it.
It has all the trappings of religion.
Yeah,
okay. There's a pilgrimage to Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. There's worshipping of this team or that team as though they were gods.
Mm, wow.
I mean,
people do think Bill Belichick is sane, so that might work.
Generally, in religions, there's a festival kind of atmosphere where food plays a big role, and certainly food plays a big role in Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all the trappings of religion.
Mm-hmm. Right. So
it might totally substitute for a...
And my God is better than your God.
Well, so this is one, you know, when people talk about like the secular world, you know, it's like, is this in fact something religious or not? Or rather, it might seem from the secular side as religion, but that, does that actually meet the halachic criteria for actual avodah zarah? All right, now well,
maybe for Scotland.
Well, so I think it's somewhat apparent now. Just I think you know you all see like why I picked this particular Gemara to focus on.
If you side with the other team, are you a scorner?
By that logic, I mean, Ziggy Wilf is Jewish and he owns the Minnesota Vikings. So would you say, like, he's actually, like, bought, you know, I'm sure, but you also have the mascots. But at the end of the day, like, you see, when you try to, like, deal with something that's completely contemporary, just how many different ways it can go. And if you want to say that it is, you know, mutar, you can easily spin this in certain ways. If you want to say that it is forbidden, you can spin that in different ways. Because, you know, you've got the nuances on what qualities of the Super Bowl you're focusing on. You've got a whole bunch of nuances on the halachic side. And you've got a multiple-to-multiple correspondence here, such that these are discussions you could have, you know, for hours. And have serious halakhic discussions. Does this match up to that? Now, you want to say that today it's similar to avodah zarah. As far as I know of avodah zarah, it doesn't really match up to the halakhic criteria, even though you might find some certain superficial similarities between them, like the lack of a deity and the lack of real worship involved. Or what's, you know...
Seriously, I to me it's like I think it's one of the core problems of being Jewish in a secular world here is being able to go to a game and the difference really the draw of what you said, where do you draw the line between when it takes over you because I mean one of the things is, you know, as like one with my son or something like that, when I tell him where the lines were, when to get away, you know, what he should be keeping, what it's just in that I think that the important thing is that enough is kept so that he's reminded of like keeping a certain mindset all the time, so he's not carried away with any other particular thing. Mm-hmm. And sports is one of those things, that could go that way. But you know, I don't prohibit him. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't prohibit him from getting involved in anything. It's just that when something takes over and you start relating everything into that world, instead of having that grounding, I think that's where there is a line there that I think is could be worrisome. And I think that's where the rabbis seem to have a.
I just read a book that made a reference to an academic study that somehow equated suicide rates with fans, like devoted fans of, you know, losing sports teams, which was, you know, kind of scary, you know, by also lowering suicide rates if you're a fan of teams that, you know, did really well. This was done based on, I think, hockey teams, not like fans of the Red Sox or Cubs. Yes, the Red Sox eventually did win the World Series, but they were known as long-suffering, but I think, you know, there was some communal bond over, like, how bad they were. There was somebody who even argued that the Cubs will never win because since they keep selling out while fielding horrible teams, there's no incentive to actually field a good team. And in fact, it would almost destroy their mystique. The way that I'll tell you how I kind of set my lines with this. It first started at YU. One of the things I loved about YU was that they had a halftime mincha. They had, like, the Beit Midrash Shul area was, like, you know, just one door, like, two doors down from where the big TV screen was where you would watch the football game. So, first game starts at 1 o'clock. Halftime, let's say, is around, you know, 2:30, wherever that's going to be. Nothing happens in the halftime of the 1 o'clock game. Like, at least in the halftime of the 4 o'clock game, you see, well, here's who won in the 1 o'clock series. But the only thing you have in the, you know, is like, you know, talking heads who usually say absolutely nothing, and here's some highlights from other stuff from the first half. So you're able to go, you know, daven mincha, have a full kedusha, right? And then by the time you're done, like, they already started the third quarter. You didn't really miss anything. But I noticed for myself, if I watched a full football game, my brain turned into jelly, such that if I watched the 1 o'clock game, the only thing my brain was wired to do was watch the 4 o'clock game. And before you know it, you waste like 9 hours watching football. There was a study in the Wall Street Journal that said that, you know, you've got the football in real time. A typical game takes about 3 hours, give or take. There's 1 hour of actual game time. It's 4 15-minute quarters.
Yeah, that's another point.
But there's only 11 minutes of actual football being played. So, and what I started doing, like, I kind of realized this, where NFL.com has, you know, after, you know, each week has highlights of all the games. So you can just go back there, you know, if you're missing it. Like, so every now and again, I'd like go to, like, I wouldn't watch a full game, but I could go, like, oh, you know, here's everything that happened, you know, oh, yeah, it's good to know, and keep it up, and you can watch basically a full, you know, day's worth of, you know, football in, you know, a fraction of the time, because they narrow it down to, like, you know, 5 to 7 minutes of highlights instead of, you know, spending 3 hours to watch a complete game. Yeah.
What I find amazing is that people will spend $8,000 for a ticket, and they won't pay for the kid to go to school.
Mm. Well, that's a priority thing. I don't know.
But I think that's also where you're not drawing a line of priorities. I mean, I think it's about if it's learning, you know, versus football. That's a clear choice.
Right. So that would be, and you know, the truth is that would apply too in terms of the priorities. And if, you know, you're a parent, I think you made a good point there about setting that up at home. You know, if you're, you know, trying to raise, you know, a Jewish family, you're trying to set certain priorities, kids follow the parents, right? So, you know, what's the kids, like, what do you emphasize? You emphasize, well, I need to get home and watch the game, or say, well, you know, watch the game, and now I'm going to go learn, or now I'm going to go study, now I'm going to go see a class. If all the kids see is, you know, oh, you know, football is important, well, you know, they're going to pick up that at things, like, well, yeah, you know, all this Jewish stuff might be, you know, like, good in theory, but, you know, we don't actually have to do it. Certainly kids in particular are going to pick up on that, and I think, you know, certainly in the modern Orthodox world, kids do pick up on a lot of that dissonance of, like, you know, here's the stuff that, you know, you're teaching me, but this is actually
this
how
you
really
act.
Well, this exactly. This is what you really get. And it's not to say, and it's not to say that, you know, the leisure part is necessarily bad, but if it gets to a point where one seems to be concentrated on more than something else, or one gets, you know, prioritized more than something else, you know, that message does, you know, keep up. And, you know, just one last line in terms of the celebratory nature here. You know, there's a pasuk in Kohelet of Tochlech Beit Evel Beit Mishteh. You know, that, you know, it's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of, you know, than a party, because at the end, you know, that's the, you know, end of all man. But you might even argue that that could be biblical support for being a Jets fan. Take that there. Yeah, we actually there is someone in our shul who is a devout Jets fan, and there was even an article I read about, well, what are you supposed to do today if you're a Jets fan? Like, do you root for the Giants or do you root for the Patriots? And, like, we're assuming that you're not actively rooting for a stadium collapse, which would put you back into that, you know, Greco-Roman type of thing, as like, ah, you know, the buses should collide against each other and the Super Bowl be canceled. Though interestingly enough, most said, you know, you begrudgingly support the Giants because it's, you know, if you're a Jets fan, you certainly can't support the Patriots. The Giants are at least, you know, they're not, you know, they're rivals, but in a different sort of way. But yeah, the Jets fan in our shul is not happy today. Anyway, so if you do enjoy the game, enjoy the game. Do it in moderation. Yeah, and have a wonderful week.